there was, well...
This is tape 5, the afternoon of January the 7th. President, we finished the subject.
Well, there's one point and perhaps another one about Theodore Roosevelt that we may want to elaborate on, because during his administration, the first Department of Labor was established, or the first Secretary of Labor was put into office.
Well, it was Commerce and Labor, one organization. The Commerce and Labor were together, yeah. And then it was separated after that. It was called the Department of Commerce and Labor.
But labor was separated out of commerce and made later, a department
later,
of its own.
Later
not
on.
Under Theodore Roosevelt?
No, it came
yes.
later. Didn't it come later?
No, that came later. The Commerce and Labor was under Theodore Roosevelt.
That's I was in the
he established the place in the cabinet, and he called it the Secretary of Commerce and Labor.
That's right.
Then after that, it was divided into the Secretary of Commerce and the Secretary of Labor. It was not Theodore Roosevelt's administration. I think it was Wilson's administration, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so, yes.
I think that's
Mr. President, also during the Theodore Roosevelt administration, they had the first Federal Food and Drug Act. What is your feeling about legislation of that sort?
Dr. Wiley, I think, was the man who got that done, and he was right. And it's still necessary, because there are more fake remedies advertised on television and radio right now that ought to be stopped, and they ought to enforce the Food and Drug Act more stringently than they do now, because all it does is catch suckers. You know, people listen to a bunch of hooey over the radio and the television and then go and purchase something that may made up of nothing but sugar and water as a remedy. And it ought, they ought to be protected, because they don't know anything about the fundamental basis of these things. And half the remedies that are put out in the old patent medicine way didn't have anything in them that was of any value to the physical setup of the human being. And the American Medical Association are the ones who ought to protect people against such things, but they don't.
Well, they only rule out those things which apparently they put through the laboratories and say are ineffectual, but they conduct no campaign against any specific medicines. They're opposed to all patent medicine.
And they're opposed to everything that is for the welfare and benefit of the common everyday man. They won't even operate on him. If they find out he hasn't got any insurance and not able to pay him, they let him go home and die. And I'm saying that advisedly, because I know some specific cases where people have gone to them for examination and it was decided that they needed an operation for an appendix removal or a gallbladder removal, and when they found out they didn't have any money, they sent him home and gave him some sweet pills. And that's absolutely wrong.
Well, that's another
monopoly. And that's one of the situations that we've got to meet and remedy. And that's the reason I wanted an assessment on people for a backlog, so that when the time came, they could pay their hospital bills and their medical bills. And the American Medical Association didn't want that to happen. They called it socialized medicine. It wasn't anything of the kind. It was to help the poor man lay up a backlog so he could pay his bill when it came time. And he could select any doctor he wanted to wait on him. He could select any hospital he wanted to go to. But he would be in a position to pay the bill. And that's all there was to it.
Well, the fortune on the basis of this bar the patient from having a doctor of his choice, whereas all the time, they've been making sure that you could not go into a hospital of your choice, only where they
That's
would
right.
let your doctor practice.
That's right.
Well, now, this proves that the Roosevelt period, although he did some grandstanding and some gymnastics and a few exhibitionisms, that he did tie in with a lot of the men on the street, pretty much.
Oh, yes, he had the welfare of the country at heart, I'm sure. And Dr. Wiley in the public health situation did a great job. And the American Medical Association has been trying to discredit him ever since.
Now, his assassination attempt in Milwaukee.
Well, that was after he was out of office.
So no. Oh, yes, when he was trying to get a... They thought he was after a third term or something. Was that?
No.
This man was tried as an insane...
Some nut just
came saloon up. Keeper in Milwaukee.
Some nut just came up and shot him and didn't do him any harm.
Shot him in
along
the chest.
His ribs, and he never even sat down as a result of it. He bled a little and
kept
got
right
all right. Kept right on going. But that was not a political matter. He was out of office. There was something up but didn't like him. They'll often do that to any former president. I've been threatened time and again since I've been home, but I've never been afraid of him. I've always said that I could catch the fellow who was trying to shoot me. I'd stick the gun down his throat and pull the trigger, but the Secret Service always told me I couldn't get to him.
President, the name of the man who was the first to hold the office of Secretary of Commerce and Labor was George B. Cortelyou.
That's right. He was the Secretary of Theodore Roosevelt.
He was the Secretary of Theodore Roosevelt.
George B. Cortelyou.
The fellow who later became head of the Edison Company in New York?
I don't know that.
I don't know what became of him, but he was Roosevelt's secretary when he was made put in the cabinet as Secretary of Commerce and Labor.
Well, now, to summarize Theodore Roosevelt's administration, where did we make important strides in the progress of the country?
Well, I think he made some very important strides in the progress of the country because he was at heart very much interested in the little fellow and wanted to help him. And eventually, in this public health thing and the establishment of the Secretary of Commerce and Labor, he made a contribution to the welfare of the country. But when it came time for his successor, he hit on Taft, who had been Secretary of War and had been governor of the Philippines and was a very fine gentleman. But he was really at heart an old-time, backward-looking conservative. And Roosevelt fell out with him and tried to defeat him at the Republican Convention in Chicago. And he couldn't do it. Taft was nominated, and then he ran independently on his own hook. And that caused the election of Woodrow Wilson. I think that's the greatest thing that Teddy did in his whole life.
Well, didn't Teddy Roosevelt irritate the big industrialists by his intervention in this epidemic of injuries that began to take place?
Trust
with many people, people working on the production lines and employees getting themselves cut up and killed and maimed. And he apparently set up or insisted that certain protective devices be incorporated into all those lines of production where people would have guards to keep them from
being... Yes, that was the beginning of it, and it was finally worked into the situation by Woodrow Wilson.
It was just the beginning then, as you explained, during those
years.
Yes,
it was the beginning, and finally it was worked out after the Great Depression, when efforts were made in the first administration of Franklin Roosevelt to get the thing lined out, and I was a part of it, I know.
Okay, all right.
Mr. President, can we get to William Howard Taft? Can you summarize him, characterize him?
Yes, President Taft was a... kindly man. He was a great big man. He weighed 330 or 40 pounds. That was tall in proportion and was as kindly as he could be. Although he was one of the men in the Republican Party who was what's called an ultra-conservative. And he fell out with Theodore Roosevelt on the strength of that situation. He was nominated for president and was hopelessly beaten in the election that took place in 1912.
That is when he ran again?
Ran the second time. He ran against Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was elected. And then a long time after that, after the Republicans again obtained control of the White House, he was appointed Chief Justice of the United States and was a great Chief Justice. He was a man who understood the law. His business had been the law before that. And I was very well acquainted with him and thought very highly of him personally, but I didn't agree with his policies or I didn't agree with his ideas as a Republican, but that didn't cause any difficulty between us. I remember on one occasion in particular, a friend of mine who was a first lieutenant in the 129th, he was a senior first lieutenant, and I was a junior first lieutenant. And he was in Washington to be admitted to the Supreme Court for the purpose of practicing in the court. He was a lawyer. And Chief Justice Taft swore him in. And my friend thought he would say something that would be pleasing to the Chief Justice. And he said, "Mr. Chief Justice, I was one of those in Chicago who voted for you for re-election." Chief Justice Taft began to laugh all the way down to the bottom of his very heavy stomach and said, "Young man, you are a rare bird, and I'm glad to meet you."
That's a very good anecdote.
Wonderful anecdote. As a matter of fact, his administration is supposed to be distinguished by only one thing, that he was the first president who tossed a baseball at the opening of the baseball season in Washington Park. And
well,
had a big attendance.
He was a kind of man. Everybody that was around him liked him, but his policies as president of the United States were not satisfactory to the so-called liberals of the country, and that's the reason he was defeated.
He completely negated the forward progressive thrust of Teddy Roosevelt.
That's correct.
Just to get a little further light on him now, as Chief Justice of the Court, were his decisions any less conservative than his acts were as president?
His actions as Chief Justice of the United States were in the public interest. I don't think he ever let his own personal opinions interfere with what he thought the law provided. And I think he was a great Chief Justice.
That's very interesting. And how do you reconcile the two men in his respective positions?
Well, it's a different approach to things. You see, in a judicial position, a man has to weigh what the Constitution and the laws provide, and has to go on a great deal on precedents. As chief executive, he's on his own, and he doesn't have to worry about the precedents or what's gone before. As President of the United States, he's the Chief Executive of the United States, which is entirely different from being Chief Justice of the United States. And I think the two approaches are very well set out in the career of President Taft.
That is a very enlightening and a very interesting sidelight on him, and it shows that there is something almost mystical in these checks and balances that have been set up, because the very same man working in the two different branches was really two different men.
That's true, and you find the same thing is true of Chief Justice Hughes, who had an entirely different approach to things when he was Chief Justice than he did when he was running for President of the United States.
Well, you say that Chief Justice Warren now, although he's been carried
on. Well, I don't know enough about the career of the present Chief Justice previous to the time that he became Chief Justice to make comparisons I have made with Chief Justice Hughes and Chief Justice Taft. I was present in Washington a great deal of the time when both of them were in the office of Chief Justice, and they were both highly thought of in all circles in Washington.
That's the end of tape 5, the afternoon of January the 7th.
Thank you.
On the morning of 1961, the president... This is tape number 1, the morning of... January the 8th, 1961, the President Noyes Hillman present.
Do you think we can put on the Seven League historic boots this morning and sort of take wide jumps from the beginning of how we got to where we did get to in terms of our situation on the outside of our country and on the inside? And then we'll take it right up to the First World War and kind of stop there as a marker. And that'll take in the first term of Woodrow Wilson.
It's all right, we'll do our best at it, so go ahead.
the progress that was experienced was not a sustained progress. We took it in hops, skips, and jumps.
Yes, that's always the case. It takes a very long time and a great many difficulties and mistakes to build a nation. That's true in the whole history of the world. And it's, of course, it happened with us. But in the long run, we've come out with one of the greatest, the greatest republic in the whole history of the world, due to the fact that we've been considerate of other people. We're particularly careful about how we treat the underdog, and that hasn't been customary in most great nations.
Well, it took us a little while before we threw off as a people the old world bad habits or bad traditions that we brought over with us until we acquired a new outlook and a new point of view and a new behavior pattern when we got to this country.
I think that's true. I think that's true, but that to a great extent was brought about by the thinkers in our own country who had been examining the history of conquests and things of that sort. And in our whole program, which really started, the worldwide program started with the Spanish-American War, we then began to think of the welfare of the people who were taken over in that war. And that's been our policy through the First World War and through the Second World War all the time.
Well, as we were expanding, we were still not chronically or intrinsically a conquering people?
No. No, that's absolutely true. In taking over the territory from Mexico after the Mexican War, Mexico was paid for it. Paid just as much for the southwest corner of the United States as Jefferson paid for the Louisiana Purchase. And the effort was made, aside from the way the Indians were treated, to create in that section the same sort of a setup that was created in the Louisiana Purchase. States were made out of it, and some of the great states of the Union came from the southwest corner of the United States. California, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico were all parts of that Mexican Purchase.
But at the same time, we allowed an agrarian aristocracy, an industrial aristocracy, a financial aristocracy, and even a political aristocracy to develop in this country during...
Well, I don't say, I wouldn't say they're aristocracies.
The concept of the word allowed, what you mean is it happened. Allowed means that somebody over on top is consciously ordaining these things.
That's a good word. I stand
and
corrected.
I don't like, yeah. I don't like to say that these developments were in the form of an aristocracy. They were in the form of an economic development which took place. And whenever the people in the financial, what you call the financial overlords or aristocracy, got too big for their britches, they were cut down a peg. Same thing happened with every other one of the things that were organized. Whenever people began to get too much power and began to think that they were in a position to run the country, they always got their ears knocked down, and I hope that'll continue.
Well, I meant really that there was a classless society. These people who were giving up class distinctions and coming into a situation where we had a classless society, classes that began to develop.
Of course, and always the case when too much power is concentrated in one sort of an organization, they begin to set up what they call a class in imitation of what happened in the Middle Ages in Europe. And it's always been our policy when that so-called class became what the ordinary fellow thought was too powerful, they usually cut them down a peg and we've gone along all right.
Well, but as a people, we were guilty of a great many abuses right from the very beginning. We abused the Indian, we abused the Negro, we abused the farmer, we abused the worker.
That's customary in every society that's ever been created in the history of the world. The main difference between ours and the ancient ones is that we correct the difficulties when they get too much, when they become too powerful and think they know too much They usually cut down or the size, and it's a good thing. That's what makes our country great.
And of course, the unique thing about this country is that there was the freedom to correct. In other words,
that's
there
right.
was never any oppression.
A man wouldn't be hanged or shot because he was against somebody that he didn't agree with.
Well, we did have some repressions, but the point is that we had within the system the ways of adjustment and readjustment as a result of this free society that we were trying
That's
to
correct,
build.
And the reason for that was that the place was made up of some of the best blood from all the races in the world. And the idea of freedom of action has always been the basis of our constitutional approach to all these things. And there's always a way to correct these things without a bloodletting revolution, and that's the reason we've continued on the basis on which we are.
Now, you used a very interesting word at the beginning when you said that the thinkers in this country had always provided the leadership.
That's correct.
You
that's
mean absolutely. The intellectuals of this country?
Well, yes, they are intellectuals. They're political thinkers who are not necessarily eggheads in the college sense of the word. Yet the college eggheads have made a great contribution to morals and ethics as it affects the whole people of the country. And then practical men can come along and put those things into effect. People who have this tremendous knowledge of things are usually not practical in the approach to a reform that's necessary to be made. It takes a politician who understands people who can make these reforms and make them work. And that's been our great asset in this country. We have people of all classes. We have the people with great knowledge. We have the people with great practical ability to make great corporations and great railroads and great businesses work. And then we have political people who understand how to control those fellows who get too big for their britches and know too much.
Now, the political people, as you call them, they're not necessarily the originating thinkers. They are the doers.
Sometimes they're not. The greatest thinker was one of the greatest politicians, and his name was Thomas Jefferson.
Well, you classify him as one of the great distinct personalities on the American political
There's
scene.
There's no doubt about it. He had all the qualifications of all the people about which we've been talking.
Now, you define George Washington as a doer surrounded by thinkers.
That's correct. But he knew how to make the thinkers work for him, and that's what a good politician is able to do.
Now, all through that very rich period, there weren't two Jeffersons, there weren't two Washingtons, there weren't two Lincolns. There was just one of a kind.
And well, that's true, and we had one in the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt took over. He knew how to make the thinkers work for him, and he had himself surrounded with people who were historically competent in the things that had happened beforehand, and that's always necessary for the head of a government. He must know how to stop before the radical thinkers take over. He must know how to make use of what they have and make it for the benefit of all the people and not for just a few.
Now, there is a period in the evolution of this nation that's called the Age of Progressivism. Some say it started with the year of 1900, and others would probably push it back a little bit to the war between the states. Now,
no, I don't know anything that would cause it to have any periodic line drawn. It was a growth that began with people who thought about the welfare of the country as a whole and who did not want to see one class control the country. And it went on and on, and finally when Theodore Roosevelt became president after the death of McKinley, he was charged with being the first progressive. He did make a great progressive approach to the welfare of the country. It was carried through by Woodrow Wilson.
You mean McKinley?
Theodore Roosevelt.
Theodore Roosevelt.
It was carried through then by Woodrow Wilson, and was finally topped off by Franklin Roosevelt. And it was a continuation of a series of thoughts and approach that had been taking place since the time of the first administration of Grover Cleveland.
Mr. President, then you would define that the American spirit and the American philosophy, both of the people and government, as a gradual progressive one, and always with the idea in mind that no one group or class or power should take over control.
That's correct. That's correct. And it is a result of the fact that we have unlimited great educational institutions in this country. And one of the first things that a new state always did was set up a state university for the education of the youngsters. And they were allowed to do their own thinking. And some of them had a practical approach to these things, some of them did not. And out of the whole arrangement of the freedom of approach to these things is what has kept our country great, and I hope it will stay that way.
But the people always had an opportunity through the polls to make any changes to meet the conditions of the
sometimes
time.
Sometimes it was difficult to accomplish, but in the long run, if they were on the right track, the results were for the welfare and benefit of the country as a whole.
The basic American thing was that you always had the machinery by which you could make the change.
That's right. It was a freedom
without
of action.
Revolt.
Freedom of action all the way around.
So that as a melting pot, it was instinctively recognized that there could be neither conformity nor uniformity where there are people who were of so many shades and so many varying backgrounds, and they were all accommodated in this climate.
Yes, and one of the reasons for that was the fact that there was a freedom of communication and a freedom of circulation from one end of the continent to the other, and that part of the continent that is the United States of America. There were no boundaries which prevented a man from crossing the state line if he wanted to go somewhere else to live. In the countries of Europe, these little countries over there in Europe and in Central America have iron fences and the prevention of all communication between the rest of the territory. And when they got over here with unlimited over 3 million square miles of land on which to work, they had no restrictions, although the state governments were locally organized and were for the government of the people on the ground. But that didn't prevent the fellow from going to another state if he wanted to. There never was any restriction on communication our transportation in this United States of America, and that's one of the great things that caused its development.
And there was, despite the very intense state rights feeling, there was never any rejection by one state of another state's individual, a citizen, crossing over and living in that
that's
state.
That's part of the Constitution of the United States, and they couldn't do it, and they didn't, because they knew it wouldn't stand up.
Well, in other words, we kept ourselves pretty healthy. There weren't any of the miseries that we had to go through that we could have avoided without having tried to shortcut the process of growth, which would have been unnatural. We had undergone a natural, progressive, evolutionary growth with all the growing pains that we had to experience during
that
process.
And the communication of information from one end of the country to the other gave the people in the Northwest and the people in the Southeast and the people in the Northeast and the Southwest the same viewpoint as to things that were going on that they had locally when it took place.
This is the end of tape on the morning of January the 8th, 1961.